The Anaheim Ducks have partnered with the OC Healthcare Agency to provide free resources through OC Navigator to Anaheim Ducks fans to help build their healthiest self. We all have difficult days or face hard times, but the resources ducks.ocnavigator.org provides to fans can help us all bounce back. There are tips that fans can utilize to ultimately be a better version of themselves, including nourishing activities, wellness toolkits, and more. To learn more, visit ducks.ocnavigator.org.
On the ice and throughout Orange County, the Ducks strive to support by giving back to local communities and programs. Join us as we take flight over Southern California on Leading the Flock.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Leading the Flock, coming at you from the Korea Studios here in Anaheim. Very special guest joining us, and Dr. Ronnie. We're going there. It's hip. It's real. It's great. I love it. Just to get your title right, Chief of Mental Health and Recovery Services. I got that right now.
You got that right.
Fantastic. For the OC Healthcare Agency. And we've had some conversations here over the last several months with some individuals that have been struggling with really drug and substance abuse. And I know it's such a huge thing out there, but before we dive into some of the challenges people are running into and some of the signs that you look for in these scenarios, if you would let people know exactly what you do for the OC Healthcare Agency. It's an incredible title. I just want to know what it means.
Me too. Hope I don't disappoint you.
No.
So I oversee the public behavioral health system. So that's mental health and addiction services for the County of Orange. We serve people who have no insurance, and we also serve people who have Medi-Cal as their insurance.
How did you get yourself into this arena?
I ask myself that every day. Yeah. Well, I think all of us have a story. So I think my story kind of led me into this space. I'm the oldest of four kids, and my mom came to the United States with me. I was born in Japan.
Okay.
My mom's Filipino, and my dad's American. So we came to the United States, and she had the rest of my siblings, and settled in Huntington Beach, everything going really well. And then when I was 10, my brother was 9, my sister was 8, my little brother was 6, my sister was abducted from our neighborhood. And so she was returned, but when she was returned, it wasn't like it is today. The police didn't take her to an emergency department to get checked out. They just brought her home, and my mom culturally just wanted it done with. So she brought us, you know, took my sister into the house with all of us, and we never spoke about it until about 5 years ago.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So about 50 years have gone by and we didn't really talk about it. Never got treatment for that particular trauma. My 9-year-old brother, who was in the neighborhood at the time, really was tasked with watching her. And since she was abducted and taken by an adult man and put in his car, my brother was sort of left holding the bag. And a lot of guilt about that. And I think our family probably put some pressure on him, like, why didn't you do something? My little brother, after that, always talked about not feeling safe. And so literally at the end of our street was our school. And so he was in first grade. He would run home. He would go to the bathroom, tell the teacher he's going to the bathroom, and actually go home, make sure my mom was still there, and then come back to school. And my job, because the oldest, was kind of to take care of everybody.
Yeah.
So that kind of progressed. My sister actually started that evening drinking. She was 8. Okay. So my dad had every good Irishman had a bar in our house. And so I would find alcohol containers in her drawer when I was putting up clothes, that sort of thing. And then a little bit after that, she started leaving at night. So for her friends, some people would just come knock on the window and she'd leave. So that progressed to a point where she then attempted suicide at age 16. And then shortly after that, my mom did as well. Just sort of dealing with, how do you deal with being a mom and not being able to keep your kids safe and not having anyone to talk to? Mental health was not something anyone did back then. And so I just really wanted to make sure I could still help people. So I went to school for social work and got my degree in social work. My siblings all addressed their trauma the only way that they could figure out how to do, and they all started using drugs. So all three of those actually started using together and then ended up all with methamphetamine addictions. And the good thing is they're all in recovery now.
Good.
So that's amazing. I think it was sort of a combination of the trauma, probably some genetic predisposition, because we have alcoholism in our family. And so that was just sort of the way they coped. And so because that runs in my family, my oldest daughter, who's 27, she also has a substance use disorder, and she's in recovery from an opioid use disorder. And another story for another day, but sure. Actually my training in this field really helped save her life because she overdosed right in front of me in my home. And luckily I had Narcan and mm-hmm. could reduce, reverse her overdose. But having that as my background, I didn't even think that was something different than what everyone has, right? Everyone has a story. But I think that really obviously propelled me unconsciously into the field. And so this is the space I feel really comfortable in and really use my understanding of what it's like to be in a really dark space to help other folks.
How did this all affect you? How were you able to get to the other side and be in this space?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I asked myself that growing up a lot. I'm wired a little bit differently than my siblings. We're all really close in age, same parents, same environment, but that's what I'm thinking it is. My coping skill really was to help other people. And that's kind of, how I was, it's in my veins sure. to do that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So, I threw myself into school and my education and just really wanted to, professionalize how I could help other folks.
Were you at the forefront when you jumped in? I mean, when I say forefront, I mean, mental health hasn't been okay to talk about for a long, long time. And it just seems like it's in recent that now it's become comfortable, especially when you have some high profile people come out right. and admit they have it. And everyone's like, I guess we can talk about it. But when you jump into this profession, you're dealing with all this stuff personally that you've had. When did your profession say, it's okay, we can talk about this now and we can start diagnosing?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think probably the profession of social work has always kind of been in that space, right? But socially, when it became okay to talk about mental health and really be able to share lived experience, that's what we call it when you actually have gone through some stuff yourself, that's pretty recent. That's probably in the mid-2000s
yeah.
is when that really started. And so I think it just was happenstance. I just happened to be in this space, and I share my story and, my family story a lot. And I'm always surprised that people will thank me or say, oh, that was so great. I can't believe you shared that. Because to me, that's just, I grew up in Huntington Beach. My sister was abducted. I went to USC. I mean, it's part of who I am. So it's, I am the person I am because of all that, not in spite of all that.
How many stories do you get of people that, similar to what, your sister dealt with and your family's dealt with, waiting some odd 50, some odd years before they could tell the story or feel comfortable about telling the story? How many of those cases do you run into?
Probably that is the rule rather than,
really?
The exception. A lot of folks don't feel comfortable, or they don't even acknowledge, they don't recognize that it's a thing that they went through. I have a lot of colleagues who are amazing in the behavioral health space and who have their own children in treatment, who've really struggled with that, and they don't talk about it.
The children now, it seems like, who are the young adults, are more, like we talked about, it's more socially okay.
Right.
Are they the individuals that are pushing their parents, the older siblings, the grandparents, to try to get in front of someone like yourself to get some help?
Yeah, we are seeing that because it is so normal. Kids talk about it all the time. They're just far more accepting, and that's a great thing, I think, about our society. It's just bridging that generational gap there is something. But we have services, in the county, obviously, for all age groups. And one of the groups that we really do watch are older adults, because what we see is a slight spike in things like substance use disorder with them. And that's not something you'd really think about grandma having an issue with meth, but there's a whole lot of that out there.
What are the signs for right now for the young adults out there that are dealing with something similar that you went? And I'll start with that as far as kind of sweeping it under the rug for so long. And now they're seeing that there's something wrong with their parents. There's something there. Because I think that counseling, I go to counseling, I go to marital counseling. And even if things are good, when things are good, I still go. And I think it's more accepted now to do those things. But the older generation, like my parents, like, nah, we need to go. We're fine, whatever it is. What's the advice you give to these younger adults to try to get their parents and elder family to try to get some help?
Yeah, I think it's cultural in that different generations seek help very differently. And so our older folks, our elders might be more comfortable getting their assistance from maybe clergy, from a faith-based organization. And so there's counseling that's available there for them. Also through their physical care doctors, they might be far more comfortable going to see their primary care doc to talk about that they're not eating very well and what it really is depression. But if you go with them and kind of tip off the doc, then the doctor can assist them. It's not as helpful, I think, to try and talk to our elders about some stuff that like kids would do.
Sure.
They're just not as open to that. But there are lots of ways, I think, too, just normalizing it. So something like this, that you have a podcast where we're talking about mental health and you've talked about your mental health and I'm talking about mine. That's really, really impactful. Any platform, any big platform like what we have right here, is just an amazing opportunity. Again, any opportunity we can publicly say mental health, mental illness over and over and over again, that decreases the stigma, just that.
How important has it been for these, I alluded to some of the, I call them high profile, but just because they're in the spotlight and they have a platform. One that Kevin loves, one that jumps out to me, a professional basketball player, another one, Simone Biles, obviously in the Olympics, right. That made a big deal. For that strength that come out. I don't think when Simone came out and spoke about it, people couldn't realize and understand why she wasn't going to go compete. Right. Have people been knocking on your door more since some of these people have come out and said it's not okay to be not okay?
Well, I don't know if they've been knocking on our door, but when we knock on theirs, they open it. Oh, so there's that.
That's a good way to say it.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they are open to coming and talking. I think there are so many folks, if we were talking about just how even in the family, so it doesn't have to be that particular, trendsetter or a professional athlete, but if there's someone in their families who's had an issue, I think even having our president, right, Joe Biden, talk about his son and his cocaine mm-hmm. issue, just having a president talk about the drugs that they're family have been struggling with, even though they all have it, putting those words out into the universe, that is amazing. So that, again, it just starts the conversation. And then people who are at home dealing with a coke addiction can be like, oh man, I'm not alone, right? This guy, and look at his parents, and they're talking about it. So it does help us break through the stigma and help people get treatment.
The word anonymous rings true to a lot of people. They don't want to have to talk right. to someone and they rather handle it on their own. That being said, the OC Navigator website is something that I know is a couple of the people that we spoke to that are fighting substance abuse have gone on the site based on our conversation just saying, hey, listen, we are partners with OCNavigator.org. And so they've gone on the site and they've had rave reviews. Is it an easy place to navigate for those that need some help that might not want to talk to someone?
Right. So ocnavigator.org or ducks.ocnavigator.org, amazing place to go. The great thing about it is there is the option when you go to the website that you can put in what you're looking for, if it's an eating disorder or difficulty with cannabis, whatever, and your zip code, then we can give you the resources that are in your area. And you can choose that yourself. But there is an option where you can actually talk to someone. And so our OC Links is a part of OC Navigator. And that will give you one of our crisis counselors. And they can talk you through anything right now. If you need to get in to see a doctor right now, or you ran out of medication and it's a long weekend, we can help you immediately. So it is a really easy to navigate website.
The Anaheim Ducks have partnered with the OC Healthcare Agency to provide free resources through OC Navigator to Anaheim Ducks fans to help build their healthiest self. We all have difficult days or face hard times, but the resources ducks.ocnavigator.org provides to fans can help us all bounce back. There are tips that fans can utilize to ultimately be a better version of themselves, including nourishing activities, wellness toolkits, and more. To learn more, visit ducks.ocnavigator.org.
When you are dealing with a family member that is dealing with suicidal thoughts or substance abuse, as opposed to a friend or someone that you know, what's your advice? Can family talk to family? I mean, sometimes that could get different, right? I mean, it can be a little more difficult because it's more personal, maybe. What's your advice to both situations?
Well, I think that really depends on your relationship, but I wouldn't wait till you have a great relationship to start talking about these kind of things, right? So if you were concerned about somebody, whether it's your family or it's a friend who you thought, man, something's not right, I'm worried that they might even think about hurting themselves, there are five easy things you can do. Family or friend, doesn't matter. The first thing is ask that question. And by asking the question, I mean directly. Don't do some weird thing where you're like, oh, you're not thinking about doing something stupid, are you? Don't say that. Just say, are you thinking of killing yourself?
Direct.
Direct. And then shut your mouth and listen to them. And when they tell you, yeah, I think about my life is worth nothing. No one loves me. I feel I'm a loser at work. Don't interrupt their thoughts and say things like, that's not true. How can you be so stupid? How can you be so selfish? That's not true. Because that's their feelings. And that's how they feel. And that is true. The idea is just to let them talk. People who are contemplating self-harm are so anxious and so ashamed that they have all these feelings. They just need to get it out. And research shows if they're able to talk about it, it decreases their risk of completing a suicide. So first thing you do is ask a question. Second thing you do is keep them safe. If they just told you, yeah, I want to kill myself, you're going to want to kind of hang out with them. By keeping them safe, the first step is that you're going to sit with them and you're going to kind of check in on them. So if your friend, you know, if Joey said, hey, I'm not doing so well, and you're like, nah, I got to get to this Ducks game. Sorry, dude. That's not real helpful to Joey. But going and hanging out with Joey, the connection is the most important thing. If we can reduce isolation, increase connection, that is protective against suicide. Third thing you can do then is to help them connect. And that just means that you're gonna sit with them, you're gonna ensure that they can get to a counselor. The easiest way to do that is to sit with them and call 988. 3 digits, it gets you to the National Suicide Prevention Hotline. That is a one-stop shop, and there's a trained suicide prevention counselor who can talk to Joey and make sure Joey's doing okay, and then hook Joey up with community resources. They work directly with us in the county, and so we will also be able to assist there. Another part of helping connect is you want to just make sure that, again, when we're trying to kind of be safe, is connect with a person and figure out, have you done this before? Have you tried to kill yourself before? The more information we have about that, the better. A really important thing, ask them too, did you take anything before I got here? And also, do you have firearms in the house? So 1/3 of all of the suicides completed in the state of California are done by a firearm. And that a person has a triple the risk of dying by a firearm via suicide if they have one in their home. So those are things to really check in on. And then finally, following up. Let's say, you know, you're there, you're with Joey, you listen to Joey, you're hanging out with Joey, connecting with Joey, you called 988, got resources, Joey's good. Follow up with Joey to make sure that, yeah, things are still okay. That in itself is super powerful. We really need to follow up. The follow-up could be a text, it could be a voicemail, it could just be you drop by Joey's house to make sure he's okay. But research shows that just something as simple as sending a card absolutely reduces the risk of suicide.
Do you notify others to say, hey, let's keep an eye on Joey, or how does that work? Because I'm sure that it was in confidence, part of it, confidentiality.
Well, if it's just your friend, one thing you don't ever do is say, I'm going to keep this a secret. Don't do that. Don't promise something you can't keep, right? And don't leave Joey alone. So if you're like, man, I got to go to work, then call somebody else and have them come hang out with Joey just to see someone through the crisis.
What are the signs from a outsider perspective, a family member perspective, that someone is suicidal?
Oftentimes they've been telling everybody that they're suicidal and that they're going to take their life. So it's usually not a surprise. There might be a big change in behavior.
Is it really?
They tell people.
They are telling people and people aren't listening.
Right. It's uncomfortable to hear that. Yeah. And people don't know what to do. So right. I just gave you some steps you could take.
No, that's good. Right? No, I appreciate that. No, that's good. Okay.
People have a personality change. So when they used to be like really gregarious and out there and wanting to hang out and all the time, and now they don't, that's a sign. One that we always talk about is they all of a sudden now they've been in a real big funk for a long time, and all of a sudden they switch and now they're really, okay, I'm good. That's a really dangerous time. Sometimes they're really good because they've made a decision about what they're going to do. Wow. And so, and also giving away things that are really important to them. Those are also signs. But the change in behavior is the biggest. If they have an increase in sleeping, or they're no longer sleeping, or an increase in drinking and drugging, or they're no longer doing those things. Any big shift in behavior is just something to point out, and then have this conversation, just like what we just did.
Are interventions the thing? Is there, I've heard that term back in the day. Is that something that is happening today, whether it be drug abuse or suicide, someone who's suicidal?
Not in the sense that the whole family gets together and says, if you don't get treatment, we're never going to see you again. That works in a very small percentage of populations, but in this space, no. Again, doing all those things, just being in someone's life, connecting with them, if that's protective, we should all have some people in our lives. So that's the biggest one. The easiest one we can all do is just make sure that you take a look at who your tribe is, and then pull them in, check in on them every now and then, just doing that sort of thing. That's kind of how we do it. But also having people reach out and get mental health support is super normal. You know, if I had some sort of stomach issue, I'd go to the doctor. No one would give me any kind of, slack about that. It would not be an issue. For mental health, it's for some reason is, right? It's not about being strong or being weak. Not about that at all. It's just about taking care of our health. We all go, hopefully, and get a yearly physical. You know, women get a well woman exam. Hopefully, you get a well man exam. We do all of that. We all need to have a mental health wellness check every year, period.
You just answered my question, because I was going to go to preventative for someone who has a 6-year-old daughter. And I'm sure there's, kids that even you're getting to high school and you're getting to the social where things get a little crazy, and the peer pressure and things of those things happen. But the preventative from I'll start with a parent standpoint. Maybe you don't get a mental health check as a preteen or a teen, but how do you keep your family healthy, mentally healthy?
Right. So I think making sure that family does a bunch of stuff together. I know my kids pretended that they hated always doing things with me. I have 3 kids. But I think it really was protective, because my kids, I knew when my kid was having an issue with heroin, because she told me. She said, I'm on heroin. I mean, that's, you have to open up those lines of communication. Checking in with your family and having it be normal that you talk about things. A really important thing that I'm glad you brought this up is that kids take their cues on how to behave by looking at us, the parents. Mm-hmm. And if we're freaking out about something, that's what our kids learn. Right? That the way I deal with this issue is I yell and scream. Or the way I see mom deal with the issue when she comes home and she's upset, she pours wine. And I'm going to do that too. So they are observing us all the time.
I'm in trouble.
So, <No. I know. laughs> but they're observing us, right?
Yes, huh?
So if that's the only way you know how to handle a problem, that's how they're going to learn to handle problems. So having an opportunity where you can just kind of emotionally regulate yourself and teach your kid, like, when you get angry, you don't go punch a wall. When you get angry, let's go for a run.
Yep.
Right? Those kind of things. We can do that with our kids from day one, just so they see that. But I think it's important, too, that kids see our emotions, right? So they don't think that something's wrong with them when they have them. But a good reminder for all parents is our kids watch us. They're going to do just what we do.
When I say social media, what's the first thing that comes to mind?
Ducks.ocnavigator.org.
You're trained very well. I like it. No.
Well, social media is a thing. Yeah. I think for the mental health impacts of social media, I think parents have to be way more involved in what their kids are doing. I think all parents need to know that their kids have on their phone all the icons they want you to see, and then they have a whole bunch of hidden ones for the social media that they use. Really important that you have access to what your kids are doing. That doesn't necessarily mean that you have their passwords, but if you have a 10-year-old on social media, you should have their passwords.
Yeah, I hear the online bullying, the bullying on all the different platforms, and I'm scared to death of my daughter someday getting on social media, whatever, however old she is, and it's trying to kind of we were talking about being preventative. Right. Everything you just said really is being a family and being very cognizant that they're watching every step you take and setting a good example. But yeah, it scares me. And has that become another segment of what you guys do, kind of another expertise of an arm, if you will, of what OC Navigator does?
Yeah, we want to be able to balance. So we also want to put out social media posts that balance some of the negative. But I think our concern really, although there is that for youth, as adults are bullying each other all over the place on social media. Mm-hmm. Every tweet you see, every post. So again, just being cognizant of what we as adults are doing. Another really important thing, because you touched on it earlier, is Snapchat as a platform. My kid had it. Great. She used to take pictures and all of that sort of thing. But Snapchat is being used by kids to also purchase online one or two pills to get them through maybe finals week. So they might get an Adderall that's used as a stimulant, or they might get a Percocet to kind of calm themselves down. They order it. It comes to their house. They take it, and it's fentanyl. And so that's how we're seeing a lot of our youth. And we've had 122% increase in overdoses, deaths.
122%.
For ages, 10 to 17 in the past year. What we're looking at is that's where it's coming from, right? So really important too, in that space, that everyone knows that if you don't get a pill, if you don't get medicine from your doctor or your pharmacist, assume it contains fentanyl. That's what we're finding in most of these pills. When we're working with our sheriff, Sheriff Barnes here in Orange County, and we're looking at the deaths caused by overdose and what was in the pill that caused the overdose, or the substance that caused the overdose, it's fentanyl.
It's being laced.
Yes, it's actually 100%. So just 2 grains of fentanyl is enough. That's a lethal dose, 2 grains. And you have a pill that probably has hundreds of grains of fentanyl in it. So social media is a great place for people to get things. It's also a terrible place for people to get things. So again, as for parents, we just need to be vigilant and know what's happening. And the only way you're going to know what's happening is to ask your kid. My kids know way more about what's happening on the street than I do as a clinician. I ask them, what's the drugs you guys know about, so that I have an idea. The only reason that we're able to do that is because we have open communication and we talk.
Yeah.
Right. They don't tell me everything, but they tell me enough. Right. And I think that's an important thing for mental health, is just that we open up communication within our families.
How has your partnership with first the Angels and now the Anaheim Ducks, how has that really taken your message and your platform to another level?
Yeah. That is a great question. Between the Anaheim Ducks and the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim, those major league platforms are amazing, because it's not just getting folks who are in a stadium or an arena. It's getting all of their friends. It's getting all the broadcast. It's getting all of that. You have someone like Mike Trout talk about, your game's not over and suicide is preventable.
They're on the...
On the freeway, right?
The outfield walls, exactly. There, you see them during the games or on the freeway. I mean, it's...
Right.
Yeah.
We have our QR code all over. I mean, that's a thing. We want to get our QR code, and that QR code will take you to the ocnavigator.org. But that just gets the message out about mental health and about mental wellness, and that itself reduces stigma. Again, it's a huge platform. And it's getting viewers at home who are watching a game, and they see OC Navigator on the helmet of a duck, then they're like, what the heck is that? And then they Google it, and then they get with our resources. And then they start looking through the pages. We track all of that. And so we see that when we have home games here with the Ducks, that our page views go up exponentially. So we can tell it's absolutely working. We just need to keep doing more of it.
And I touched on it, earlier, but I'll bring it back just because now we're talking about both franchises, that athletes a lot are looked to as like robotic. They're not people. Right. And I think they unfortunately fall under the pressure of being, unpenetrable or what have you. Right. But now you mentioned fentanyl, and that's creeped into clubhouses and locker rooms across all different sports. And it's a real problem. Are you... I'm not sure I want to phrase this question as far as just, are athletes now opening up and more and trying to get help from some of these things that maybe they didn't think was a problem?
Yeah. Yeah. I think we are seeing that if just watching professional athletes' tweets come out about, you know, that they're struggling with a mental illness or that they're dealing with an addiction and they're having to take time off or be on the injured list because of that. That has really shifted things because then people look up to their idols, right? They look up to this professional sports person and then they see, okay, man, she who's so strong and is doing all these things, she's struggling. So it's okay for me. I can get help too. But I think it also opens the avenue for professional athletes. They are people, right? They're people who have a job that's really hard, but everyone's watching them do their job. Mm-hmm. And they need to have some support as well. So when I see an athlete do that, usually if I see it even on Twitter, I will retweet and say how amazing that is and what it really does to for the rest of the world who's watching, because we are watching them. You know, they need assistance just like all of us.
How do you stay mentally healthy in all this?
Well, I don't know if I'm mentally healthy.
Besides wine, the story you told me to start, your background and how you got into this, your daughter that you shared. And by the way, thank you for sharing all those stories, because I think people are listening to this, or when they listen to it, hopefully they can relate. Well, yeah. You don't want them to, but hopefully right. That helps them.
Right.
But how do you balance this space, you called it earlier, with trying to stay happy and have this, you know, great attitude about things?
Yeah. Well, I always see myself again. I am who I am because of all those things that happened in my life, not in spite of them. So those things made me stronger. They made me who I am today. I always try and find like one good thing every day. So again, when my kids were little, I would ask them when I picked them up from school, what's the best thing that happened to you today? And it might not have been a good day, but they'd have to figure out what was the best thing, right? To kind of, you know, glasses half full, not half empty. So we do that.
You know, sparkles and farkles.
Exactly.
That's what we have.
And
yeah.
I just have to keep at that. Yeah. When I get to a place where I'm feeling like, oh my gosh, you know, I have a big responsibility at work and I do a lot of other things on the side and I have my family, when I'm getting like overwhelmed, I just do the fancy word for it is mindfulness, but the regular word is I just kind of take a breather. And so that's what I do. And all we'd have to do when you have a bunch of noise happening in your head, a super easy thing to do to stop that is to yawn. So physiologically, when you yawn, you can't really do anything else, right? So try it. I mean, when someone's talking to you and you yawn, you're not really listening to them anymore. It's like you turning your phone off and on. That's what happens. Initially, you can do a fake yawn, and pretty soon afterwards, you're going to have a real one. But when you yawn, like purposefully yawn,
okay.
It shuts your brain down just for a second and allows you to kind of, you know, take a breather. Super easy one. And, you know, other ways people do that is they put a rubber band around their wrist and they snap it, and that kind of brings them back.
Okay.
That's an easy one too.
Interesting. Okay.
But it's all just really about focusing on the here and now. Like, don't worry about the stuff in the future. Don't worry about the stuff in the past. Just worry about right this minute, right? So if I were feeling overwhelmed, which I'm not, but if I were right now, my whole thing would be, okay, I'm sitting here. I would kind of ground myself. So I'd pay attention that my feet are on the ground, my butt's in this chair. Mm-hmm. I'm here right this moment. I'm safe. I'm having a really good conversation with you. This is fun. I'm okay right now. So I don't have to worry about, oh my God, I have to fix dinner. I have to go to the grocery store. All those things that our brains normally kind of amp up and do. So I do a lot of that kind of thing too.
Those are wonderful pieces of advice. Very simple. And I love the simplicity of them. I was going to say so long, but I can't because I have something else I want to talk to you about. Something that I've personally been affected by is with some of the people that we've spoken to, more along the substance abuse line, it's the people that they've affected and hurt along the way that feel left out, feel like, wait, all of a sudden this person has gotten this help. They're on the right path. They're getting, you know, some accolades of going the right way. They're still fighting addictions. They're still fighting that need, but there's family members, girlfriends, wives, whatever it may be along the way, that have been left behind. How do you recommend helping those. I think that's the way I wanted to say it. Yeah. I'm trying to figure out how to phrase that, but I think how do we reach out to them and make sure that they're not forgotten and they know that there is help, and how do we help them?
Yeah. Those who are left in the aftermath.
Yeah.
Having been that with my kid mm-hmm. and my siblings and others in my life, I know that space. It's important that they get help themselves. So easy ones are like Al-Anon, and each drug has its own 12-step group for the family members so that they can realize that their health is important, whether or not their loved one continues in recovery or not, that they still have to be whole, right? That their life shouldn't be surrounding their loved one's addiction, which kind of is what happens. That becomes your purpose. No longer can be. You have to really start focusing on yourself. Those are self-help groups. They're available. You can find those at ducks.ocnavigator.org.
So you can find them on the site,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. Yeah. 12-step fellowship or 12-step groups, AA, NA, Cocaine Anonymous, you know, Marijuana Anonymous, any of those, Alcoholics Anonymous, all have a part of the organization that's for the family members. Your loved one doesn't have to go. It's just a place where you can hear from other folks that, man, I've been through it just like you, and you're doing okay. I can be okay too. And it just really is good, free support for people who've been left in the aftermath.
Yeah. And that's been, I think sometimes that we speak to people and hear stories, but we hear their stories. Right. And they're the only stories that we hear.
Right.
And we forget that there's so many other stories that have surrounded that individual through the course of their lives.
Right.
And that is something that certainly I wanted to bring to the forefront in this conversation, and at least start that conversation with you. And I appreciate that. And I hopefully this is just the beginning of you and I talking and having these conversations, because I know as we continue to do this, people are going to reach out. They're going to have more questions.
Great.
And I'd love to be able to address those and talk to you about them. Before I let you go, though, can you tell all the different social platforms that they can reach you, reach ocnavigator.org? I know we just said it, but everything else, anything else that I'm missing?
Yep. No, ocnavigator.org. You can go there and find any resources. We are at ochealthinfo.com. That's the county website.
Okay.
You can go there if you wanted some county services. But again, easier place is the ducks.ocnavigator.org.
Love it. Well, Dr. Ronnie, it's an absolute pleasure meeting you and doing this. And like I said, hopefully we have many other conversations down the road.
I hope so. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. This has been another episode of Leading the Flock on Duckstream.
The Anaheim Ducks have partnered with the OC Healthcare Agency to provide free resources through OC Navigator to Anaheim Ducks fans to help build their healthiest self. We all have difficult days or face hard times, but the resources ducks.ocnavigator.org provides to fans can help us all bounce back. There are tips that fans can utilize to ultimately be a better version of themselves, including nourishing activities, wellness toolkits, and more. To learn more, visit ducks.ocnavigator.org.
This is an Anaheim Ducks original production on Duckstream.